Thank you guys for coming out. This is a panel on pervasive electronic games. My name is Julian Bleeker. I'm a professor at the University of Southern California in the Interactive Media Division, where I study things like electronic games and how they can become pervasive. So I'm moderating the panel, so I'm just going to give a little bit of context to help sort of flesh out what we kind of collectively mean by pervasive electronic games. And I think most of the fleshing out will happen through presentations through these three amazing practitioners of pervasive electronic games. So in my mind, this sort of motivation comes from looking at very traditional forms of play prior to the existence of electronic media. So I tend to investigate the forms in which plays developed through, in this case, like traditional children's games, just the kind of activities you do before start thinking about getting online and these kinds of things. So I've been looking at sort of these inventories like this book that are just these big inventories of children's playground games, and looking at how what the dynamics are, what the kind of mechanics are that go into this form of play. And as I've been doing this over the last several months, I've looked at things as just different kinds of game gestures. To forgive my horrible kind of sketches, I'm definitely not an artist, but these are just sort of from my own notes. And like looking at the ways in which physicality develops in traditional kinds of playground games, and I've noticed that the gestures that people have when they sort of go through these games are very familiar to electronic games. So I've been looking at how this kind of crossover between the gesture of sort of reaching out to something and interfacing with some object to play can help shape and inform like new kinds of electronic play. And I've been thinking a lot about how there might be a mode of play that I'm just sort of loosely calling like offline gaming. So where you're doing kind of gaming activities, but you're not actually doing them while you're physically sitting in front of the computer. So walking around in the normal sort of human world might be a kind of play or game mechanic. And also looking at how game interfaces have sort of evolved. So, I mean, this is like the game interface that we live with today. We're sort of clicking a button and we're moving a mouse around. It's starting to evolve so that we're actually moving these controllers around, so there's another sort of like incremental degree of physicality that's going on. We're sort of expanding the portal through which we see these games. So instead of our little 12-inch screen, now we have 53-inch plasma displays. And I start thinking about how this evolution can continue so that other things can become game interfaces. So you might go to the farmer's market, and that's actually an interface to a game. Or you might physically go snowboarding, and that somehow is an interface to an electronic game. And I think some of the projects that my colleagues here will show will start explaining how these kinds of activities can actually become game interfaces. And so with that sort of contextualization, I'm just going to go ahead and move to the panelists and start. I don't know, who wants to start? I guess you're all set up?
Yeah.
Okay, so we'll start with Aaron Myers, who's a third-year MFA candidate in the Interactive Media Division at the University of Southern California, and he'll be showing some work that him and some other colleagues at USC have been working on.
Thank you, Julian. All right. excuse me. So I'm here today to represent a project called Mob Zombies that me and Will Carter, who's in the audience over there, Will, raise your hand. Worked on together. Mob Zombies is a game with a pretty simple premise. You're this guy with sort of an exposed brain, and you're basically being chased by a bunch of zombies. But the twist is that you actually move around physically in the real world in order to move your character in the game world. So we do this with sort of this sort of jalopy thing here we got that we use two sensors together to sort of coordinate this kind of motion, and we got sort of, so there's like a digital compass that is up here, and this thing houses an accelerometer that you clip to your waist, and so using sort of the compass to get your heading and the accelerometer to detect your motion, we use that to sort of move your character through the world. And so basically there's this continually growing horde of zombies that chases after you, and you have to sort of avoid them and use bombs to explode them. And so you get these bombs and you drop them, and they're sort of time sensitive, so you have to avoid their explosion for your own safety. So once you drop a bomb, you sort of have to bail and run. So just to give you a better idea of it, we got a video we put together, so I'm gonna show that to you, and it'll give you sort of a...
Could we dim the lights, yeah, please?
Dim the lights, dramatic lighting, please.
Okay.
So, yeah, that should give you sort of a better idea of what I'm talking about here. Yeah, so I guess you can sort of, we got the moving around. So the next phase of this project, I guess, that we're going to go on to is we're working on a mobile version that can work on a mobile phone. Because right now we've got this thing, and it runs on this little Sony Vaio thing, which is actually a full-on XP computer, and it's not really something... too many people have around the house. So we're looking to sort of put this onto a mobile phone with a J2ME. And we're also working on sort of a more streamlined version of the sensor rig. Then it'll all work over Bluetooth. So the idea being that we can sort of have a cheap sensor rig that people can get and maybe play this on their mobile phone. And we're hoping to release this as sort of a kit with open source, so people can sort of use this as a platform to create, you know, their own games and stuff with this same sort of modality in mind. And I guess that's it. Okay. Julian?
Thank you, Aaron. Next, I guess we'll have Kevin. Are you set? Okay, Kevin Slavin is a game designer extraordinaire, works as a principal at Area Code in New York City, where they develop very interesting near future forms of mobile and pervasive electronic play.
Also, thanks to the Boston Police Department for allowing us to continue, because I know this is really scary. Okay. What happens? Let's see.
Oh, you need sound, right?
Yeah, I could use sound. I'll take it if I can get it. Okay, so among the different things that I'm gonna basically try to do a little whirlwind tour of some of the things that we've worked on, some things that other people have worked on, just to kind of set the landscape so that we have sort of stuff to talk about, because it's so vast in a way, the idea of pervasive games, that it's good to have sort of touch points to draw from. And one of the things I wanted to start drawing from is from this, which is kind of an old one. You reach the province of Karazhan. Here are huge serpents 10 paces in length. At the forepart near the head, they have two short legs, having three claws like a tiger, eyes bigger than a loaf of bread. The jaws are wide enough to swallow a man, and the teeth are large and sharp. So I don't know who knows this one, but this the answer is that you fix spikes. This is not from an adventure game from the 80s, but rather Marco Polo's diaries from about 1300. This is actual travelogue, and... you know, this is sort of in underneath pervasive games is a very human instinct to lie radically about where we are. That there is some fundamental need to produce fiction about the places that we go. Whether it's the city of gold, which is the reason that, you know, half the hemisphere speaks Spanish and Portuguese, looking for the city that we still haven't found, or this house, which is built to reproduce precisely the houses from the show Dallas, which is built in the middle of this village in Romania, where Dallas is the number one show. The fact is, and underneath pervasive gaming again, is that places need stories to make them seem real. There's something that we as humans need to do here historically. And the facts are that most places are real and that, in fact, most stories are not. And beyond that, it's that a lot of places aren't real either. And that as we spend more and more time in these fictional spaces, it's crazy to think that if the average World of Warcraft player is spending 20 hours a week, it's crazy to think that the types of interactions that we have there with millions of people at once, you know, with this type of interaction, it's crazy to think that that's going to stop just because we stop playing the game, right? That's not going to leak out into the rest of our lives and onto the streets, et cetera. And so what happens is that you start to see types of games that we've never really seen before. That's Dennis, by the way. You start to see things like geocaching, which is treasure hunts that are distributed among millions of people, for millions of people. This is from Conquest, which I'll show you more about in a minute. This is from a game that we did in Tokyo called Superstar, which used optical recognition through the lens of the phone to make a game that was built around recognizing the people in the stickers, in Porikura stickers, which is a kind of emergent behavior in Tokyo. It's a game about getting famous, basically, by putting your stickers up and having other people photograph them, automatically recognizing them, et cetera, et cetera. Underneath that is the basic premise for us of pervasive gaming, which is that there's always something over on the left, which is terrestrial, static, made out of atoms, stuff, right? And then there's always something on the left, on the, you know, on the right there, which is made out of ether, which is made out of data. And that there are ways that to combine these things now, that there are ways for these to lend properties to each other, and that changes how we play. Thus the name of the firm. I'm going to go through this really quickly. There's basically, you know, I came out of advertising, there was the media department and then the digital guys or whatever, right, on some other floor with separate P&L. And there's all these technologies in the middle that are specifically about connecting these two spaces, that are specifically about connecting the world outside with the ether. And we're interested in those technologies. So big games, large-scale, real-world, multiplayer games. One of the ways that we talk about it is we say that these are games with computers in them rather than the other way around. This is not about trying to take you further and further and further into a fictive space within the boundaries of the box. In fact, it's about taking the computing power and to change the circumstances around you, to use the computer to change the conditions that you're in the real world. These are games that restore social interaction and physical context. Two games which, you know, I think this is a really important thing, right? Is that what do video games exist in the context of? Do they exist in the context of computer graphics, or do they exist in the context of gameplay? Because if they exist in the context of gameplay, whatever it is, a couple thousand years, right, games were always social until recently, right? And now they are again. And this is something that we've heard a couple different times. Sometimes we say it's read-write urbanism. How do you write back to the city? Right? I'll leave it up for another sec. People that share space should share experiences. That fundamentally, these are two pictures that were taken within 2 hours of each other. This is a father and son who've just got off the plane. Their batteries are depleted from the plane ride. They're sharing the same AC coming out of the airport. They're on the same Wi-Fi network, and they're in completely different worlds. As opposed to 2 hours later in a cafe not 5 miles away, a young couple who's sitting next to me playing Mario Karts, who were, in a way, kind of the most engaged couple at the cafe because they were having several layers of conversation, whereas a lot of other people around me weren't even talking to each other. So Conquest, let me do it for a minute, it was an advertising thing. It was inspired in part by a really terrible, terrible science fiction movie called They Live. A really great science fiction film from the 80s. It launched Rowdy Roddy Piper's film career. The premise of They Live is that Rowdy Roddy Piper finds on the streets of L.A. a pair of sunglasses that allow him to see the world as it actually is through the jamming frequencies of the aliens. So when he looks up, all the ads actually have other texts. And when he looks up at somebody on stage, he can see it for what it really is. So we would look like this. So, yeah, like this, right? That's what that actually says, et cetera. This, by the way, is what inspired Shepherd Fairey. So it inspired us too. This idea of having a lens onto the world, the idea of being able to see things underneath the world or on top of the world. Never mind that. We launched a game called Conquest, and this was the first use of this technology called Semicode. Semicode is an optical barcode. If you look at your mail where the stamps used to be, that's the code that's there now. What's good about that is that it's chunky enough that the lens of the camera can decipher that. Okay, that means that we can produce things out in the world that are legible to machines and not to humans. That we can create what we think of as public secrets. So we built a game out of that. This is my favorite game designer, by the way, Frank Lance. Actually, let me just show you the video really quick because that's the fastest way in here. It's taking about 5 minutes to load. Okay, there we go. Okay, let's see what happens.
Down today. Really odd.
Sorry, I get really choked up. I see that stuff. That's the goal, by the way, is to make the weatherman talk about what you do. I'll show you some of the things that came out of it. This was one of the teams in Denver was a ROTC team. They came with elevation maps of Denver. They've been planning the attack for about a month. These are kids who showed up in Minneapolis with a chain of command that you see on the lower right, which is more complex than the one that we use in order to build the game. I don't know what happened there. These kids, I have no idea what's happening there, but they won. And we started to see interesting things. If you want a good strategy to win under 60 minutes for the upcoming Conquest games, contact me. I'm a member of the AHS team from the Denver Conquest. Okay, what's interesting about this, the kid who's writing this from the Denver Conquest no longer has anything to win. He's not in the game anymore, right? And that if we see people who are trying to cheat and they're not even in the game anymore, it means that we've hit something. It means that there is some emotional resonance, that there is some kind of investment in the game that is not just merely transactional, like, okay, I'm playing now, and now I'm... This is Pac Manhattan, which came from my partner Frank Lance's class at NYU ITP, which had such stars in it as Dennis Crowley. Get ready to see a funny shot of Dennis. The conceit here is very simple, of course, which is to consider the lower grid, the grid of lower Manhattan as the Pac-Man board. It's relatively straightforward. All you need is Pac-Man and a couple ghosts, and the play pretty much writes itself. That led us to start thinking. We were commissioned to do a game, and it was not long after Hurricane Katrina. We were interested in the traditions of carnival for obvious reasons. There's so many resonances in terms of what we're all doing. And that there's a European tradition. There's also the Afro-Caribbean tradition of funeral parades and what became the second line in New Orleans, which basically was shut down by Katrina. Zulu officials earlier had said the organization would not parade. It was forced to deviate from its traditional route. Its traditional route, I'm going through this way too quickly, of course, but its traditional route was no route. There was no specific plan. It's exactly the point that second line parades don't have a specific program as they move through the city. That ended with Hurricane Katrina because of the problems of policing it. That sort of led us to build a game as a kind of love letter to New Orleans that featured the Baron Samedi, sometimes known as Papa Bones, who's a spirit whose mojo is murderous. This is a GPS game for two players, small scale. One of the things about this, right, is that it's GPS, which means that if you do it in a city, you can't do it in a lot of the city, right, because you have urban canyons. You can't do this where there's a lot of tall buildings. So we did it in this neighborhood in Lower Manhattan, partly because Jane Jacobs lived there, and it was partly kind of a love letter to her as well, and partly because the buildings are just low enough that we could get a reliable GPS signal. I wanted to show this. This is how we develop games, right? I mean, these are still games. And there's a lot of technology that goes on, but it's a lot of game design. And this is playtesting. This is development. I mean, it's rolling dice, it's cardboard, it's figuring out what the system is and then bringing that out into the real world. This is what it looked like in action. It's two players. There's the sun and the moon. The Baron Samedi is taking a right on Leroy Street. And of course, the Baron doesn't actually exist, right? His position is being tracked as surely as our own, but he doesn't exist. You don't want him to touch you, so what the result of this is that you could end up being running up Hudson Street, being pursued by something invisible, okay? And that's the type of experience that we can produce now, and these are the types of experiences that we've never really been able to have before. These are people playing it. This is Fright. This is debugging, by the way, right? This is a very interesting problem in pervasive games. Okay, so you hit a bug. You need to be somewhere where you can see the GPS satellites, a Wi-Fi network, and get the boost cell phone signal. Okay, and it needs to be where you're actually playing, right? So we had to set up shop in a Dunkin' Donuts that had loose Wi-Fi, because that was sort of the only point where these three systems converged, as well as being within location. So there's the types of problems that are being worked out here that the likes of which we haven't seen before, that, by the way, are not specific to games. They're just sort of starting here. This is the first location-based PC game. This uses a Wi-Fi positioning system. It's sort of like a geolocated Dope Wars. Depending on where your PC is, you wind up at different islands that have different values. Bananas are very expensive in my neighborhood, whereas gunpowder is not as expensive. Opium is a fixed price, as in real life. Different people are playing. They're producing these islands. I have no idea who these people are. And when we wake up in the morning, we just see that new people are moving through this fictive world that has been placed on top of the real world. Urban golf. If you've ever played Golden Tee and you know how video game golf works, this is like that. It's using GPS and a technology that allows the phone to detect what direction it's pointing in. It's like a compass. So the hole that you see here is 125 meters straight ahead. The player lines it up, lines up the shot physically, clicks the button when the power is right, and now the ball will travel to wherever it is calculated to have traveled within the game. You have to go there now, right? You've got to go to wherever the ball has ended up and get it closer and closer to the hole. Very straightforward, very different way to see the city. So we're building a course in Chicago that is basically taking you from place to place. But with a very different set of criteria, much like Marco Polo had, for example. Some stuff we didn't do, but interesting, right? The idea that you would have outdoor media that doesn't interact with your cell phone is going to be really weird in a couple of years. So this is a memory game that somebody did. I don't even know who did it for Bank of America. This is a Rock'em Sock'em Robots thing that somehow accrues to Chevy. In Times Square, people can play with their phone. This was some stuff we did for Nokia that got killed. Some stuff. Okay, this is something that has nothing to do with us, but it's super interesting. This is called Webkinz. How many people know about this already? Yeah, this is going to be really big. Webkinz are they're stuffed animals that have unique codes that unlock the world online. The idea. That physical things will have virtual properties and virtual things will have physical manifestations is sort of the essential thing to think about as we move forward. And that there's a million different ways to do that. Even stuffed animals can have virtual properties. Some stuff. I'm pretty much going to end with this. This is something we just finished for The Sopranos. So when we think about the spaces that we're trying to affect, we sort of stumbled into television through a bunch of different ways. Because it turns out that live TV is a place where a lot of people are hanging out, right? That like, you know, that's right, because live TV, there's millions of people doing that at the same time. We're always trying to think, like, where can we go where there's hundreds of thousands of people hanging out at once? Like NASCAR is good, stadiums are good, whatever. Turns out TV is really good. That's where millions of people are hanging out, all doing the same thing at the same time. We were hired by A&E for the launch of The Sopranos. This is somebody who's collecting pieces out in the real world, through the optical recognition of their phone cam. This is somebody collecting a Tony piece. I won't go too much into it. Depending on how you arrange your pieces, think about it like fantasy football, right? There is this space that is the live broadcast of The Sopranos, right? And people are playing based on what they think is going to happen tonight on The Sopranos. Okay, and depending on how they arrange their pieces, this yields very different results, these two arrangements. Depending on how you arrange your pieces and which ones you've collected, you get very different scores. I'm going to show you how this actually played out. Okay.
Dad, we're eating.
So this is live. That's the TV in the background. And what you see in the foreground is the browser responding real-time, live, in synchronous broadcast with the television, right? What we've never really seen before. It's like this is adding a layer to The Sopranos, which is in a way already there in The Sopranos, which is the complexity of the narratives. You'll see in a second, as Tony comes through the door, you'll see the Tony piece light up right on cue. And wait for it. Tony.
Tony!
Yeah. Boom. Okay, right. So so basically the ways that people are kind of re-engaging with The Sopranos, because this is the whole problem, right, is that it's just reruns. And not only are they reruns, but they've got ads in them, and they're censored, and there's a million reasons to not watch The Sopranos. And so we gave them reasons to watch. This was echoed in one of the emails we got. The bottom one, are you going to continue this game with another round? Frankly, it's the only reason I and everyone I know I'm watching reruns. And it, in a way, I mean, this comes back to, like, well, what drives games? It's a question of re-enchanting something that's familiar, right? It's like, you know, as surely as we build these for cities, about thinking about, like, well, what are the new layers that we can add to my commute, right? What are the layers that we can add to media itself? Some stuff. This is something we just started, where we will... We will pick up the ambient Bluetooth data from the pictures that are uploaded to Flickr and start to visualize them. A different Bluetooth will be worth different things. Obviously, we're not going to reveal anything more about it, but you could see that tooth fairy might be worth more than another, because that one's been seen many times by other players, for example. But the idea that there is ambient data, that we're swimming in it, that we're soaking in it, that it's all around us, and how do we bring that to life? Okay, like, yeah, it's great that you can, you know, get to where you're going in a more efficient way, but we're sort of interested in the least efficient ways. Because the reality is that, you know, as we're sort of soaking in this data, we can use these things to represent things perfectly. You know, like it is, you know, it's like that's what SketchUp is about, and that's the whole dream of Second Life. We'll do an exact replica of the real world. And, you know, and maybe the point is not to use all this data to represent everything perfectly. Maybe the goal is to absolutely misrepresent, right? Maybe the goal is not to become accurate. Maybe it's not to create reportage, but rather fiction. That there are ways to think about these things that you know, although these are although these have the sort of simple precision of data, in fact, we've always used stories to navigate. We have always used stories that even the stars themselves, we related to those as stories, and that was how we moved the ships. That's how we decided where to go, and that's how it should be still. So.
That was great. Thanks, Kevin. It was inspirational. I think it was actually so inspirational, we don't need Dennis, so you can just... Yeah.
And now I'm going to do the table cuts.
I should never have taken this stupid third seat out of here.
It's on. Thanks.
So, hi, my name's Dennis. Is that on? Sweet. My name's Dennis. I've worked with
with Kevin and Frank Lance in the past in some games, which has been kind of interesting. I've done the stuff called Dodgeball. I have to show the obligatory Dodgeball slide. Thank you, Justin. That's nice. And I don't know if anyone's been using Dodgeball down here. It's basically like location-based services, mobile phones, social software all put together. But it's all about like knowing where your friends are and being able to collect this data about where people are, putting it on a map, and so you have some kind of framework where people are. It's like, this is what a sample message looks like. We're getting this information about where your friends have checked in and where they happen to be. So it encourages rendezvous behavior and whatnot. So we've been working on this. I now work on it at Google. I have to throw up my standard legal slide. So let's just move on beyond that. Anyway, so the Dodgeball stuff has been kicking around for a bit, and it was developed at NYU's IDP program as my thesis project with my pal Alex. He's in the back over there. Hey, dude. And so while we were building this stuff out, I was also doing these, I was working with Kevin on that Conquest game kind of to pay the rent, and then I this is all pre-Google, and then we're also working on that Pac-Manhattan big game. So while I was doing, while I was at ITP, I still got bit by the gaming bug, and so even though we were doing this mobile social software stuff, I tried to take some of those game elements that interested me most and really drop them into Dodgeball, and it's stats stuff that interests me, and I'm really nerdy about that stuff. So if anyone's on Dodgeball, I don't know if you've gotten this monthly digest, where we try to take just the experience of, hey, I'm checking in, and turn it into like a very lo-fi game. It's like, okay, well, listen, you've got 8 check-ins this month. Here's where you've been. Here's how you rank against your friends. Here's how the places that you go to rank against the places where your friends go. And here's some of the top users. And we found that, by introducing some of these competitive elements, people got crazy about it and started checking in more, and it just drove usage and, further just, interest or, I guess, advanced my interest in adding some of the game elements to the Dodgeball stuff. We've got these other stats. It's like, here, just check out where you've been on, how do you check out and break out over time, days of the week, or based on venues or whatnot. And I've got this really weird, like, competitive thing in me, and I think it has to do with having a younger brother that I'm super competitive with, and us growing up on games like, the NHL 94, I think, changed my life in the sense where this is the first game where it actually meant something to play a game or a couple games, because it would save stats over time. And I'd enter my name. It's like Dennis versus Jonathan. And Dennis won 5 games, and Jonathan won 3 games. And you turn the cartridge off, and when you put the cartridge back in, it would remember that. And so there was some kind of, in thinking back of like where this whole getting bit by the stats bug thing came from, I think it really started here. This started making me crazy about thinking about, well, just how do you collect this information? What does it mean over time? Well, has anyone know what I'm talking about with the NHL 94 thing, getting bit by that? Sure, okay, thanks. So moving on, I've also been very interested, since the ITP stuff, and, well, how do you take, the elements of game design and bring them into the real world? And how do you make real life into a video game? And how do you make those stats, the same kind of competitive feeling that I had with, like, NHL and some of this other stuff, the way games have progressed, and how do you make that stuff work in the real world? So I made, like, the lowest, low-fi game. It's like Pedometer Wars, where I bought 10 pedometers, gave them out to my friends. It's like, wear these every day. We'll just record the stats. It's not even a game. It's like a really lame excuse for it. And then, every time you would input your data, you'd be able to see who was walking the most. And it's really lame, but at the same time, it encouraged, or it really changed the way, or potentially had the way to change the way you would experience a public space, right? So I would get to points where I was playing this, and I know that my friends would be updating their steps, and I'd get to, a combination elevator or stairs. And I'm like, well, normally I'd take the elevator, but if I take the stairs, I might be able to inch out Diane for today, and therefore get me over her for the week. And so just triggering that type of interaction where, I still do it here, walking around here, walking at the airport, just conditioning yourself. It's like, just by adding this simple mechanic, maybe it can change the way you think about the way that you, just interact with the city on a regular basis. So this went on. The problem with Pedometer Wars is that pedometer is really dumb. It's not connected to the network. It doesn't have any USB or anything. So this game got really boring after 30 days or so, and people were like, I'm not carrying this around. I'm not going to update it anymore. And so that could just kind of faded away, right? But at the same time, this thing called Nike Plus came out. Now, I didn't work on this at all, right? But this has, like, blown my mind in so many ways. So Nike has this thing that you hook into the iPod. You take that little red thing, and you stick it in the shoelaces of your shoe, and you put this little doodad on the bottom of your iPod, and then you go running with it, right? And every time you go running, it tracks where you've been, right? So this is, I've been really lazy recently. I'm sick, that's why, right? But here's, like, my runs over time. It's like, oh, you ran half a mile. Actually, I ran a lot more before that, so. and it took you 5 minutes, and your pace was this, and you burned this many calories. And you can see your runs over time, and it breaks it out and lets you see the levels and stuff. So this is really, like, nerdy, statty stuff, and I think that's why I'm, like, so super, super in love with it. It's like, oh, my God, I can see all these runs. It's great. Then they started adding this this multiplayer stuff, right? And so this is a contest I was able to have with a friend of mine. You can make these challenges, and you can say who's going to run the most over 10 days, who's going to run the most times, who's going to run the most miles. You make these little goals, and you can compete back and forth. Alex and I were doing this at work, you know, and it's like I have a hard time motivating to run, and I think most people have that same experience where it's like, you know, you're laying in bed in the morning, and it's like, why would I even go running today? What's the point of that, right? But this is exactly like NHL from before, where you know if you don't go and someone else goes, those stats are there and they're stuck on the internet forever and there's no way to escape that, right? And so there'd be moments where you know, you'd get up and it's like, shit, if I don't get up and run today, Alex is going to run. He's going to be ahead of me for the week. And so it's like it's that little extra step of motivation there. So then they also started adding this stuff where you had you can plot your points you can plot your runs geographically. Now the Nike thing is kind of, it's a little bit smarter than the pedometer because it can hook up via USB or FireWire, whatever the iPod does. But at the same time, it's not really location aware. So you got to do all this stuff on your own, like draw these maps out and whatnot. And so this is like the run that I run in the, normally mornings in the East Village, I just run up to the, down to the tunnel and run back. It's like 5 mile loop. Right, and then this one day, this is all this summer while I was playing with this stuff. And then I walked over the Williamsburg Bridge, right? And they've got this bike path and they've got this pedestrian path. And I was walking over it. There was graffiti on it, and it looked a lot like this. It looked like this one-up power-up guy, you know, like from Super Mario. And someone just spray-painted that on the walkway. And I was like, man, that would be awesome if I could run over that and get super special powers, right? And so that's the incentive to run. Like, why should I just run around in a straight line when I can zigzag through and pick up all these things, right? I was Googling around and I found a couple of photos of just like people doing 8-bit art as graffiti, and I was like, that's awesome, that's super cool, right? So I was like, I'm going to build this in New York, and I'll make it for runners, and we'll play around. But then I got really lazy, and it didn't really work out. Here's the thing what I wanted to do. I wanted to take these and just drop like Super Mario style power-ups, like, you know, on the street where I can run up and get these things. And I don't know, maybe the star makes me run faster, or maybe the one-up gives me an extra day if I, you know, am hungover and I decide to sit in sick one day. I didn't really think too much about it. But then this is what happened. I got really lazy. Fall came, and then snowboard season came around. This is my transition into snowboard season slide. And I was like, I'm not going to run outside anymore, and I'm not going to work on this. So I go skiing most weekends with my brother and his hyper-competitive friends. And so we bring this like nerdy stats thing up to Vermont where we go skiing every week. And we have this whiteboard. And it's like, how many days did you get on snow? Like, how many of the secret gold chairs did you take? How many times did you get stopped by ski patrol? Like, how many hamburgers did you eat? It's like this whole thing that's just like, it's stupid, but it's just us trying to compete with one another. So it's like, how do we make a day full of skiing super, super competitive in the same type of way that the Nike Plus became and that like the that NHL was way back in the day? So I bought these GPS units, and I've been experimenting with, this is that Boost mobile phone on the right, and I've got, that Garmin GPS thing on the left-hand side. And the Garmin one is cool, but it's like the pedometer, it's like the Nike Plus, where, hey, it can connect to my machine via USB, and I can get the track log data off of it, like the GPS coordinates, but it doesn't do it to the network in real time. The phone does, so I'll talk about that in a second, but I've been mainly using this, like, the GPS unit on the left-hand side here. This is what the data look like. So I strap this thing on my arm, and I go skiing all day long, and every 15 seconds, it just takes one of these readings, and I can dump it off at the end of the day, right? And then I went out, and this is the mountain that I ski at. It's called Mount Snow in Vermont, right? And so I went, over the course, in the beginning of the season, just went and collected all these GPS coordinates. So I'd spend the first half of the day just skiing the trails and, with a paper and pen, just like, okay, this point right here is this trail. This point right here is this trail. And I just did this a whole bunch of times. It was really boring. But now I have all this data. And so at any point during the day, I can look down and say, oh, this GPS coordinate, and that maps this exact spot on this particular mountain, okay? And so then I went out and I was like, all right, let's assign certain points to trails, and I'll give these to my friends, and we'll go out and we'll turn a game of ski, a day of skiing into this one big game, right? So you can look here. It's like, okay, here's some stats for me and my friends over one day. And hey, this green circle is worth 5 points. The black diamonds are 20 points. The run through the snowboard park maybe a little bit more. But it got kind of boring because we're all skiing together. And so it's like we all came up with the same amount of points at the end. It's like, this is the point. Like, how does this get crazy? It's like, all right, well, let's think back for a second. Here's the map that I have. We can put Super Mario power-ups on it. That'd be cool because then we can do certain things, right? And I was like, has anyone ever played RC Pro-Am? Yeah, this game is rad, super rad. And so RC Pro-Am, it's like, it's this old school NES game, and you got these remote control cars, and you pick up these things, and it powers up your car, and you have weapons and missiles and oil slicks and stuff. So it's like, why not take those power-ups and put them on the mountain, right? So that's what this is kind of what I've been working towards, like just taking these existing old school like 8-bit metaphors and dropping them on the ski hill. And so, you know, the general net effect is that you're, as you're riding around, like we'll send, I'll send text messages out. Now, we can't do like, any type of real-time stuff because the GPS device is too dumb to talk to the network. So it's like, all right, well, you know, the power-ups get scattered throughout the mountain in the morning, like everyone kind of signs up to play, and you get these text message alerts, you know, and you might get them on a run, you might get them on the, when you're on a chair, but it's like, the missiles are on this trail for the next 30 minutes. First one to hit that GPS coordinate wins those missiles, right? And then once you get the missiles, you, it's almost like a card role-playing game where you're on the lift, and you can secretly say, I'm going to use the missiles on this run. And whoever is the one that gets in front of you at the very end of the trail gets, you know, gets blown up, and they lose all their points for that particular run, right? And so it's almost like you're playing, you're earning these things. You don't really know if you've skied over them or not because you don't have that real-time feedback loop on the GPS device. But, you know, like just through basic text messaging, like interaction, you can kind of play this out. And I'm hoping for, like, by the time next year rolls around, this will all be working in real time with some of the Boost mobile phone GPS stuff. So, yeah, so you get the same type of data that we had before, but now you can say, oh, yeah, I picked up some points for getting that roll bar on exhibition. I got hit with missiles on Upper Canyon. Oh, you can't really see when I'm pointing at the screen, you know. But you can start to, you have these same runs, but then you can also start to vary the degree of points that we were getting. And, you know, it's weird because the last thing you want when you're skiing down the hill is to be looking at a device and really bothering your day, right? But as you're going up the hill, as you're on the chairlift, you've got 8 minutes to kill, you know, for every 5 minutes that you log skiing. So it's kind of like, it works out as a perfect little interaction there. And then what we started seeing, and this stuff is, it's really buggy, it's kind of half-baked, but a lot of the interactions that we started seeing is you'd go down and then you'd wait and just kind of pretend to be tired on the corner or whatnot as you let someone go by, you know, let someone go down and finish the run just so they can get destroyed by those missiles that you have, or just that you know that they'll hit like an oil slick before you will or whatnot. So yeah, just taking like traditional 8-bit metaphors, trying to drop them on the real world and just see what really happens with that whole thing. And so, again, it's like the device that I'm waiting for is this guy, which is the, you know, the Nike Plus, plus some form of GPS, plus some form of network connectivity. We're not there yet, and I think a lot of the stuff, well, I mean, those devices are out there, and you can get them, like, with Boost mobile phones and whatnot, but they're not there for the masses. And once, you know, someone comes out with something that's a little bit, you know, like, low-powered, pretty cheap, enough for people to start playing with, like, this presentation gets a lot more interesting because there'll be a lot more people experimenting in that space and starting to blow these things out. Like, it's all kind of cobbled together now, but it gets really interesting in, like, 12 months. So I think that is my last slide. So thanks, yeah. You can email me.
Great. I'm glad we kept you on the panel, Dennis.
Yeah, thanks. I earned it.
So this is the time for like question and answer. I'm more inclined to turn to you guys for questions, although I have some of my own, but I think that it'd probably be better if we start a little conversation. And we have a question.
My question is to Dennis.
Dennis, hi.
When is Dodgeball coming to Salt Lake City?
Oh, I don't know. I don't know the answer to that. But yes, we are looking to expand the product all the time, and we welcome suggestions. That was my formal answer.
Google service mark.
Yeah, thanks.
Hi, I'm Tricia Creekmore from Discovery Channel. Everyone at our office was just salivating over the Sopranos game. And I was just, what I'm wondering is how much does it cost and what's a realistic kind of traffic that you get from that? I mean,
Well, that's probably a better conversation to take offline.
Okay.
Because that data belongs to A&E.
Oh, it does.
Right? So,
but are they happy with the ROI then?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. So. The measures are how many people were playing, but also what did it do for The Sopranos? I don't necessarily want to take the conversation down this track, but basically, there was a new reason to watch The Sopranos, and there was also something. There was a way to talk about The Sopranos that wasn't just in terms of reruns, that was in terms of the systems that animated it from a narrative perspective underneath, and that's exactly how a lot of the coverage was written. So, yeah.
One of the first panels here was about alternate reality games, the ARG games that are starting to take off. And there seems to be kind of some blurring of the lines between what you guys are working on and that and those areas. I was wondering if you guys felt the same thing and if you've encountered that or what you consider any of the stuff you do to be ARG games.
Yeah, well, with our game, Mob Zombies, I think ours is definitely has a tighter link to sort of the digital games that Dennis was talking about, and it's really sort of about a really responsive action to your own actions. So I think that's a pretty strong point of divergence from ARGs that typically don't really have this sort of dynamic of moving and having it correspond to some sort of world, I guess. And yeah,
I think that there's also there's two things that are typical within ARGs that are slightly different from what a lot of us are pursuing. One is that a lot of ARGs focus on puzzle solving, and what makes that especially interesting is the collective nature, that these are puzzles that are so hard that no one person can do it. These are things that require thousands or millions of people to work on at once. That's not necessarily the types of things that we're specifically focused on. In fact, what we're interested in are more the systems for people to engage in, to play with one another, and that these are actually formal systems. It's ARGs tend to be about constructing distributed narrative, and narratives that can go in any direction. Of course, the games that we're doing have narrative elements, but they're not about leaving the narrative up to the actions of the players, per se, any more than any other game is. So.
Chairman, my question is to the panel. How do each of you solve the kind of service discovery question? How do you let people know it's okay to play? And is there such a thing as a kind of big urban game that right. You can sort of just casually get into or out of?
Yeah, I mean, that's a really good question. I mean, there's sort of two ways to think about the stuff that we all work on. One is sort of event-based, and one is kind of pervasive in the traditional sense, which is that it's sort of going on all the time. The thing that I think there's this thing that's sort of somewhere in the middle, which is, for example, the way that Dennis is talking about what he's doing, which is that there's an infrastructure for ad hoc events. And if we can construct that and make it so that there is something that is sort of always available to activate for small groups, for example, I think that's one way to think about it. But service discovery is a huge issue. I mean, part of it is, you know, how do you discover that you have Tetris on your phone? There's conventional. These are business problems in part, and it's business. That's part of what will solve this. The other thing is to have games that produce physical media, so that is part of the queue and the system in play. But it's a difficult problem.
I think it's really hard to think of them as pickup games for now, just because the tech can be so niche. I guess that's involved. Where, you know, in my case, it's like, all right, we have to have the device. The GPS device has to be set in the proper settings. Has to be uploaded to a certain place at a certain time. It's just really difficult to get all that across to someone that's like, I just want to experiment with this. And I think that's true for a lot of the other mobile games as well. You know, as you know, the technology becomes a little bit more ubiquitous, it gets a little bit easier to make them more casual and more pickup style.
Yeah. I'm not really sure what the context for someone playing Mob Zombies on their mobile phone would be, but, you know, I can imagine someone maybe walking to work or something and wanting to get chased by zombies on the way and, like, you know, blowing some of them up. But I guess sort of one of our sort of motivating factors in designing the game was we just kind of wanted to make people look silly as they sort of traverse the environment. So I'm not really sure where we can go with that in terms of it making an inviting experience that everyone's going to want to just pick up and play.
You know, sorry, there's one other thing actually that we've discovered through doing Plunder, which is the location-based PC game, which is that when we conceived of it, we thought, okay, we'll make a game that everybody can play on their laptops together, and when they're in the same place on the laptop, these things will happen and this and that. And then we found out that, like, okay, the resolution of the real world is really enormous, you know, it's like really, really detailed, and that the likelihood of two people necessarily being in proximity to each other turns out to be really low. So one of the things that we think about as we move forward in this is that proximity doesn't necessarily need to be synchronous. It may be about things that, my location matters and what the location of other people matters, but not necessarily at the same time. It could be that what's happened here affects the game.
It's more like a play-by-man chess game.
Like play by location chess game. Yeah, somehow. I mean, that's sort of the model that we're thinking about as we're learning from Plunder. So, yeah.
So it's, excuse me, I'm so laryngitic. You're tweaking data, and you discovered a world full of data to play with, and that's why you're geeking out, and you're tweaking narrative. And I'm wondering, I'm thinking of where you were at 5 years ago when I was just barely getting to know Dennis, and maybe I knew Kevin and didn't. But what's going to happen in 5 years? What's it going to look like? Can you guys talk about your best case scenario for what these games are going to look like further out?
I always think of the city, like in New York City, from New York, by the way, as like a whole bunch of little magic squares, right? And so as you're walking by, there's like, you know, every single sidewalk has got these little divisions. And those magic squares are geographic triggers where you can step across them and, you know, something could happen. And something eventually will happen on your device when it's GPS enabled or some, you know, some kind of location sensor within there. And then you can start, you know, just start having more people interacting with these types of experiences where it's like, oh, because we know you're at this particular spot, you know, we know the proximity of other users and we can create an ad hoc game right now for people in this neighborhood. Or because you pass this particular spot, you earn certain points, you unlock certain things, you unlock a different level for this part of the city. So, like, my big thing is it's all about location. I think all the work that I've been doing is based on that. And, you know, since 1999, I've been sitting around thinking, all right, in 6 months from now, all the devices will be location aware. And 6 months from then, and 6 months from then, and it just keeps going on and on and on. And it seems like we're still getting closer to that, but if that's like the one big thing that has to happen before a lot of these things are going to start to take place. It's like, get the devices location enabled, get software on the devices, and get, like, you know, at least educate people on how to get some of that software, make the interest around so they can get the, you know, get the, those experiences onto their device. But yeah, so hopefully, like, by the next time we're up here, a lot of that stuff is solved.
It's also, it's important to sort of make this point that, by the way, this thing already is location aware, right? This knows exactly where it is right now. It's just that we can't access that data.
Yeah.
It's not a technology problem, and I don't know what the expertise of everybody in the room is. These are not technology problems. These are business problems. This phone can recognize what it sees. It can recognize what it hears. It can access everybody in my contact list. It knows where it is. But we can't really touch most of those things yet. So 5 years from now, I'd like to see those business problems solved so that we can take advantage of the technology that exists right now. So.
You said that much better than I did.
It's interesting. It seems like, you know, when I was a kid, we used to use our imagination. You know, step on a crack, break your mother's back. You know, the hot spots that were there. But my question is actually about... I'm trying to help people create, you know, real world communities, co-housing neighborhoods and whatnot, and use the digital realms as models for to give people more of the experience. Do you have any general principles or lessons learned in bringing people between those realms or places where people seem to get stuck more than others?
I mean, Dodgeball is really the best example I can think of.
Of
bring people together in real life through these types of systems.
Yeah, but without a narrative assigned to it. You know, it's like the dodgeball stuff is just, it's all utility-based to know where your friends are. But once you've got, the key thing is getting all those dots on a map. And once you've got those dots on a map, then you can start making all these interesting things happen. Like, dodgeball is just one, you know, it's like one, I guess, like front end on that data set of a Google map with a whole bunch of pushpins in it. And it could be your game or any of the stuff that you've been talking about. It could be a number of different things with a number of different narratives involved in it. Like, ours is probably one of the simplest, uses of that data set.
Kevin, you spoke about people, this human need to lie about your location, your surroundings. And, you know, I see this happen all the time, like, New York people talking on their mobile phone, lying about where they are just by a block or two, you know. And it seems when we use these location-based devices with all this, you know, GPS coordinates, you lose that ability to exaggerate where you are or mislead people about where you are. I was wondering if any of you had thought about tweaking this or done anything to...
I think the goal is not necessarily to mislead other people. I think the goal is to mislead yourself. Right. I mean, you know, the goal is not to be able to misrepresent your position to anybody else. The goal is to rethink what your position is for yourself. And of course, these technologies can be used for every possible form of evil we can imagine and all the ones that we can't. But I think the question is, how do we use them how do we harness them for imagination rather than information per se?
Hi, I'm Dan Hon. I'm from a company called Mind Candy, and we make the Perplexed City alternate reality game. So what we have is we have a kind of persistent world that we've formed online. And about a year and a half ago, we started looking at helping people navigate that world in the real life as well, and not just through websites, not just through normal social interactions. And we figured out that we could probably do it in the UK, in that we could get access to all the cell ID data from all the operators and everything. But that, as you said, there's a major business problem in the States. And for us, that's a big deal because 50% of our audience is in the States. And I just wondered, you know, how optimistic are you that, you know, aggregators will spring up so that we can go to one company and we can get all this data? Because seriously, when we were looking at this, we gave up. And then we said, okay, well, we'll just get the parts. We'll get a GPS chipset. We'll get, you know, a GSM, GPRS chipset. And then we'll just try and make this ourselves.
Yeah, that's a really gross question. It's really bad. I mean, it's just like it's impossible, you know, unless you really know like global telco infrastructure to understand how retarded we are in the States in the conventional, in like the actual meaning of the word retarded. I mean, we are held back. We are restrained. Like we're like wearing mittens, right? there are very few reasons to be extremely optimistic in the short term. I mean, what we see is the handset manufacturers are integrating GPS into the units. That's cool, except GPS is really, it's problematic in cities, which is where people tend to cluster. We like Wi-Fi positioning systems a lot because they rely on unregulated bandwidth. Mm-hmm. You can get a very accurate fix on your location. There's a company called Skyhook Wireless, which is a joint venture between Nokia and Intel, that basically can, you know, like in a city with a lot of Wi-Fi routers around you, can tell you when you move across the room. These are super interesting possibilities in the interim on the way to something inevitable.
But even that, I mean, for us, we need to have as many people playing as possible. So there aren't that many people who are using their laptops or PDAs with Wi-Fi all the time.
Right.
There aren't even that many mobile handsets that have Wi-Fi. I mean, my handset has Wi-Fi, but I hardly ever turn it on because I have 3G data, and you know, that's good enough.
Right. But people's laptops, for example, have Wi-Fi, and their PCs have Wi-Fi. I mean, these are hacks.
Yeah.
In a sense, on top of some problematic issues. But yeah,
Thank
it's
you.
A huge problem.
Hi, thanks. Very stimulating panel. I wanted to ask, I think there's a lot of these pervasive games seem to be about multiplayer and sort of engaging people in communities in ways they haven't in space. I wonder if I could hear you, Aaron, talk a little bit more about what you see for the multiplayer potential of Mob Zombies. But then conversely, Dennis, I would love to hear what you think. If you were not able to use points and you weren't able to compete against your brother, what would running across a mushroom possibly do for you on a run? How could it augment your running?
Mm-hmm. Well, right now it's a very single-player experience, and there's some sort of technical issues that would come up around trying to put two people in the Mob Zombies world. We've got a lot of drift and inaccuracy that sort of comes with the way that we're using these sensors that doesn't really affect the way that you play it in a single-player way. It's still totally good enough, but if you've got two people in the world and they're both drifting out of the you know, an accurate account of their motion.
Is this like Tokyo Drift, or...?
No. But maybe we can incorporate some Tokyo Drift gameplay into the multiplayer version. But it's occurred to us, and it's something we're thinking about, and maybe if we can sort of... I mean, Mob Zombies sort of originally started out as a GPS-based project, which, you know, there's actual correspondence to terrain if you use that. So maybe we can... possibly sort of use GPS in conjunction with the sensors we've already got to sort of create a space where people could sort of compete, and that's definitely something we've thought about. And putting it on the mobile phone definitely is more enabling to have networked stuff going on. So as we move forward, that's definitely going to be a consideration.
For the single player, I guess, like power-up situation, The Nike Plus stuff, even if you're not competing with people, it's still relevant because you're competing against yourself in a lot of ways. And so, you know, if I end up getting around to that this summer and just dropping those power-ups into, you know, along the East River in New York, probably stuff that just shaves seconds off your time. You know, as I was really just thinking about it as you asked the question. And, like, I run the same route over and over again. And one of the things that's great about Nike Plus is it drags you out of bed in the morning. It gives you a reason to go out there and run. You know, to the point, like, I've been out and, you know, it's like, shit, I forgot to bring the sensor. Like, I should just go home and go to bed. Like, what's the point of even going out and running? You know? But that's, like, the negative part of it. But I would love to get to the point where, you know, if that stuff was communicated in real time, it's like telling me to go through the city in a certain way. It's like, now take a left here because there's something on the corner you need to get. Now take a right here and just follow these paths. So instead of me just getting up and doing the same thing and making exercising kind of a chore, like letting some of the power-ups or letting, you know, not even power-ups, but just letting some of the location elements in there just kind of give me a different experience to tell me what to do and how to experience, or just how to, you know, just alter that, you know, the daily run, which is usually just a routine you're doing all the time, but anything you can do to kind of mix that up a little bit or to throw some of those, like, just those abstract elements in, I think would be interesting.
Situationist running.
Yeah.
So I think that's all the time we have. Thank you for your attention. Thank you very much to the panelists for putting together excellent presentations.